Okay. For those of you who think that I don't sound like Bonnie Rennie, this is true. Bonnie is with her mother in her mother's apparently final days, and she couldn't come to this convention. So she asked Linda, who is a member of the Seniors with Vision Loss Committee, to take care of this session in her absence. And Linda said she would, and then she said, but I have to be at another session at the same time. So she asked me if I would, if I had ideas about who could do it. And I said, well, the only idea I have is that I could do it, I guess. My name is Roger Peterson, and some of you know me as the second vice president of CCB. And by way of credentialing for this session, I am a member of the Senior Advisory Committee of the City of Mountain View, California, which is an appointed body appointed by the City Council to advise the city government on senior matters. So I think we're acquiring a few more people, it sounds like. It wouldn't be senior time, but okay. All right. By the way, so we are trying to get started, guys, so hold it down.
Sorry, Roger. We're a little late.
That's what I said, senior time. And I'm 69, by the way, so I get to say that. Do we want to find out who's here? That would be great if we could do that. You want to do that? I think we only have one, Don.
Okay, well,
I'll take it. Nancy from Redwood Empire, Santa Rosa.
I'm Mike Keithley from Mountain View, California. I'm the president of SVCB.
I am Susan Hyatt again, and I'm from San Jose. I am the vice president of the Silicon Valley Voice of the Blind.
Shirley Manning from Los Angeles.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Shevlin. I'm with Society for the Blind. I'm Jane Cardis from Ukiah, California.
Okay, you want to see. And here we go, you're next.
Diane Phelps, Vacaville.
And you?
Josie Conklin, Sacramento, Capital Chapter.
Okay.
You
need us. Nancy McCurdy, Woodland, California.
I'm doing it.
Lucinda Duggington, Yolo County.
Okay, and you?
Okay. Joe Smith from Department of Rehabilitation.
Heather Frank, Society for the Blind.
Okay. I'm Don Wilcox from Palo Alto, Silicon Valley. Give it back to Roger. Could you say who you are before you say
Bonnie
that?
Bonnie Smith.
And from where?
From Woodland.
Woodland? And you?
Rosie Robinson, Woodland.
She's
Woodland.
From Dixon.
She's, okay, I'm told there's a correction. The first one was from Dixon, not Woodland, but I don't know.
Thank you, Don. Don, as you some of you may remember, is my cohort at the. She's the one who runs it, and I work for her as volunteers at the Vista Center for the Blind, where we have in Palo Alto, where we have a health library, and we look up stuff on the web for people who want some health information. And Don has some stuff that she'd love to give to you. She's that way there'll be room in her suitcase for something she buys from the exhibits. Okay, so our first group here, we have a group to speak to you, are from the Senior Impact Project, right, which is part of the Society for the Blind in Sacramento. I remember when they had a senior, they had something else called Sir, where you had a house, right? And people.
That's right. You had a home gym.
where people, it was like a little OCB. But they do it differently now, and they're going to tell us how they do it. And we have, and I don't know what order they want. I think there's, we have Shane Snyder, we have Elizabeth Campos, and we have Ann Jacobson, right? Is that correct? So I will just hand the mic down and see what happens.
Good morning, everyone. Well, yes, you can certainly hear me, right? thank you all for being here. I hope you're enjoying your CCB conference experience. This is my first conference, so I'm looking.
Where your room is.
Yeah. I see we have a heckler in the audience, so.
Some of the rooms are in walking distance.
Some are in a different weather.
Well, despite where your room is or, you know, whether or not it's warm enough to get in the pool today, I hope you'll enjoy yourself. I am Shane Snyder. I'm the manager of the Senior Impact Project at Society for the Blind. We're a local agency that provides services for folks who are blind or have low vision. And what we do is we try to get people the skills and resources and tools, the mentorship that will enable individuals who are losing their sight or have lost their sight to continue to live productively and independently. And that's what we're all about. And the Senior Impact Project is an extension of that, designed specifically for seniors 55 and over who are in the process of or have lost vision. And we're going to talk a little bit about the project and what it's all about, how it started, what it is today. But I'll talk a little bit first about how I got to be where I am today. And first of all, bear with me, because normally at this time in the morning on a Saturday, I'd be in shorts and a T-shirt carrying a load of laundry, you know, up the stairs and getting ready to clean my bathroom. So I'm a little out of sorts as far as that goes. So, yeah, do bear with me. But I am legally blind. I've known since I was a teenager that I have a condition that leads ultimately to almost complete blindness. I'm not there yet, but it is progressing. So I've known most of my life that I'm going blind. And honestly, that was not an issue to me when I was in my teens or my 20s or even my 30s. It always seemed so far off. And although my vision diminished slowly and slowly, it didn't have a huge impact on my life until I was in my mid-30s and I had to stop driving. And that was big. Yes, yes, yes. And how that happened was that I was making a left turn from one busy street onto another busy street here in Sacramento, and my attention was somewhere for a moment, and suddenly in the crosswalk in front of me, there's a woman pushing a stroller with two little kids behind her. And I had to slam on my brakes, and I burnt some rubber, and just stopped a few feet short. And I put my head out the window, and I said, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. And she wasn't too fazed. She said, oh, that's all right, that's okay. But honestly, as I drove on, I realized that had my attention been drawn away even a half second more, I could have taken out a family of five, you know. And so I made the decision right then and there to stop driving. I sold my car to a student of mine for $1, and that was the end of my driving days. But so that was the first event that really hit me hard in terms of having to realize that my sight loss was going to affect my life in a very big way. And I went through a number of months of depression and anger over that, but ultimately I adapted. I learned to use public transit. I learned to walk a lot more, rely on family and friends for rides, and I adjusted. And it didn't take too long, and it wasn't that difficult in the long run. And in all other respects, I was pretty much able to function. I was a high school English teacher, and so I was reading and grading huge amounts of paperwork. Was able to do that. I could read fine with glasses. And that went on for a number of years. But a few years ago, about 4 years ago, I found myself one day realizing that I could no longer read my students' work anymore. And that was a devastating blow because I was, you know, I had been a passionate reader all my life. I devoured books constantly, and of course I read a lot of student papers and work, and suddenly I couldn't do that anymore, at least not the way that I'd previously done it. And I was, I wasn't sure what to do. What I did do eventually at the suggestion of someone I knew was go to Society for the Blind and see what they could do to help me adjust to the changes that were happening in my life. And so I started taking some classes. One of the first ones was orientation and mobility, cane travel. And on day one, I saw what was happening here, and I said, well, no, you don't realize that I'm not there yet. I don't need to use a white cane. That was despite the fact that I was constantly banging in the coffee tables with my shins, open dishwasher doors, planter boxes, benches, you name it. And my shins were just a roadmap of scars and wounds. And she said, well, have you taken a look at your shins lately? And anyway, we worked a little bit with the white cane, and at the end of the lesson, she said, now, look, I want you to take this cane. I want you to take it wherever you go and practice what we've learned today. And I said, well, all right, but for how long? And she goes, well, for the rest of your life. And I was so, oh, my goodness, I was so angry. I mean, I just went fuming out of there. And for a couple days, all I could think about was, oh, these folks don't know what they're talking about. I don't need this. I'm not blind. on my way, but not there yet. A couple nights later, I was walking to a bus stop near my house, and I was still fuming about this. And while I was walking and fuming, I wandered off the sidewalk into a driveway, and I hit a concrete retaining wall, and with my shins again, and went over onto the lawn of the place, flat on my face, pretty hard, and I rolled over on my back, and my shins were both bleeding, and I'm looking up at the sky, and I suddenly thought, I get it. Okay. I get it. I get it. Now I get it. And so the moral of that story is that I began using the cane, and I've been using it all the time ever since. And so I tell all this because for me, making the decision to take advantage of services like those that we offer at Society for the Blind, that we offer in the Senior Impact Project, has been a matter of acceptance. Acceptance that, yes, I am losing my sight, yes, I am blind, and for me, that condition is going to progress and worsen. So I can choose to wallow in that, to be depressed and angry and sad and so on. And I've done that. I've spent plenty of time doing that. But in the end, it doesn't get me anywhere. And what I found is when I make that decision to reach out for help and take advantage of all these wonderful services and learn all these things about what techniques and strategies and technology is available to help me continue to live my life, to continue doing the things I want to do, that I need to do, just like I've always done, just doing them a little differently. And that's the thing, is what I've learned is I can pretty much continue to do what I want to do. I just have to learn a different way to do it. And at Society for the Blind, that's what we do. We teach people alternative methods of doing the things that they want and need to do. Now, the Senior Impact Project, in a moment I'm going to turn this over to one of our instructors in the Senior Impact Project, and she'll give you a few more details about what it's all about. But essentially, we provide services in several ways. We provide in-home training and instruction for folks who, for one reason or another, usually mobility issues, aren't able to get outside the home as much and maybe can't do the kind of training we offer at the society. And so we go in the homes and we teach people how to find ways of doing the things that they need to do, everything from cooking to cleaning to shopping to operating their appliances. We teach them methods and strategies, and we give them tools to do that. And we also have two retreats that we offer to our senior clients every month. And one is a 5-day retreat, and one is a 7-day retreat. One is what we call a day retreat, and we bring our clients, our seniors, in every day for 7 days for very intensive training that teaches them skills and strategies and techniques and provides tools for them to continue to live productively and independently. We have the day retreat for our mostly local clients, and then we also offer what we call a residential retreat program, which is a 5-day program that we hold at a local hotel in downtown Sacramento. And residential means that folks check in to the hotel on Monday and they spend the night for 4 nights, and they have a really amazing experience where they get to not only learn all of these skills, and they also get to know very well other folks who are in the same boat, other folks who are losing their vision, and they get to share their feelings and their experiences around that. And it's a terrific bonding growth, and it can be just an amazing experience for folks who choose to take part in that. So we're very pleased with the outcome of these endeavors. We find that our senior clients who either receive in-home instruction or go through our retreat programs come out with more confidence about their ability to do what they want and need to do, and they come away with tangible skills that they can use in their day-to-day living to, as I said earlier, live productively and independently. So to tell a little bit more about what goes on at these retreats, I'm going to turn over now to Elizabeth Campos. She's one of our instructors, and she'll tell you a little bit more about what goes on at retreats. So thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Elizabeth Campos. I'm better known as Liz around the society, and I am a rehabilitation instructor with the Senior Impact Project. One of the neat things about our program is that all the instructors that the clients receive training from are blind and have low vision. So you get training from people that have been where you are now, that know what it's like to experience vision loss and how to, and have managed to move on from that point and get training and be productive in their lives. Some of the things that we focus on are daily living skills, how to cook for yourself without burning or cutting yourself. We talk about labeling and organizing your clothes, how to become a more independent person when it comes to making personal choices, such as taking your medication, dressing yourself, picking out your clothing, going shopping for groceries and clothing, and those types of things. We also teach mobility training. How can you take the bus when you can't see anymore? How to use a cane? How do you navigate? How do you get to the grocery store? How do you ask for customer service? Those type of skills that are very important for people when they can't see anymore. You know, even though you can't see, you still need to eat. You still need to be able to get dressed. So those are skills that we teach, and we help reinforce those by being people that are blind and showing, being a good example of what a blind individual can do and accomplish with the right training. We also go into technology, so adaptive technology for the computers, scanners, recorders, things that help us become organized and keep track of phone numbers and those type of things. So we touch on all different areas of a lifestyle of being independent. And as I said before, because all of the instructors are blind, we have a first-hand experience at what works and what doesn't. And sometimes we work with clients, you know, in their homes and try to come up with solutions that work for each client individually because not everyone's the same. So we actually take the time to work with the clients and figure out what solutions, what's the best way for us to accomplish these goals that you have for yourself. And our most important goal, the thing that we work for the most, is getting these clients from being shy and apprehensive about blindness into being independent and confident regardless of their vision loss. So we get people sometimes that come in very timid about their vision loss, and by the end of the 7 days, they are totally confident and ready to take on the world, regardless of how much sight they do or don't have. So we teach them a lot of different things, and 7 days sometimes isn't enough, so we go into the in-homes and where we work with the clients one-on-one and try to make sure that we give them the right foundation for their independent life. And I think I spoke really fast, so I'm sorry, I tend to do that when I'm a little bit nervous. So I'm going to hand the mic over to Ann Jacobson, who has actually been through our program and is now a rehabilitation instructor.
Thank you, Liz. My name is Ann Jacobson, and I have been around the society, and I say around in many different ways, since 2003. That's when I lost my sight. My left eye went in 30 seconds when I entered from bright sunlight into a little bit darker room. It was like fireworks going off. Absolutely beautiful. But did you?
That was cool.
But but 30 seconds later, I was left with very little eyesight in that eye. And so I went a couple weeks. It didn't get better. I just kept trying to rub it, thinking it was something on it or something. And so, okay, I can still work. I can still, you know, work two jobs. I can live my life, drive my car with one eye. So 9 months later, the other eye went, but this time it went really slow. It took 3 days in December, and that eye became the worst eye, and that bad eye became the good eye. I lost all my peripheral vision, most of my depth perception, and what vision I have is that dull after the 30 seconds thing. I have two-thirds of that in the left eye, and that's just about it. It's very... So, obviously, I'm legally blind. So, my cousin got in touch with a lady who had gone through OCB and was legally blind. She'd been a vice principal at Christian Brothers High School, and she thought she could help me. Well, first thing she did was she came and got me and took me to the Society for the Blind, insisted I buy a cane. I didn't want a cane. My eyesight was going to come back. No way did I want a cane. I bought the smallest, skinniest cane that I could find, hoping nobody would notice it. Yeah. And it's explained to me that people usually buy these canes just like for restaurants or something. I didn't care. If I had to buy a cane, it was going to be small. So I bought the most inappropriate cane that I could buy. So she then showed me how to ride the buses, took me down to paratransit, helped me get signed up and everything. But while I was at the society, I met Michelle Bruns at that time, and she told me about the senior project. And would I like to come? No. My eyesight's going to get better. Well, may I call you in a couple of months when we're going to have an opening? All right. So this was January. By May, I was sick and tired of being a couch potato, sitting there feeling sorry for myself. So I said, okay, I'll come. I had the privilege. This is when we still had the house in Natomas, and we went for 10 days. I had the privilege of attending there. And I was down. I was really down, depressed, and feeling sorry for myself. And I went. The first day, I was scared to death. Second day, I got a little bit of confidence. And I learned that I could cut up an onion with learning shades and keep all 10 fingers. It was amazing. It was amazing, all the different things that I learned. The mobility. I learned how to cross the street with learning shades and live, not get hit by a car, to listen for the sounds of the car. and where they are according to how you're standing.
Those cars that make sounds.
Yes. Yes, some don't nowadays. I think back then a lot of them did. So, you know, just the simple things in life, how to put toothpaste, you know, get the toothpaste. You put it by your own tube of toothpaste if you live with somebody and squeeze it in your mouth and brush your teeth. Just simple things to keep you going, doing the same things, but in a new manner, thinking outside the box. It was invaluable. One of the number one things that I received from this society at that 10-day retreat was the ability to smile again. My self-esteem went up. And I informed them that I did not want to continue my previous lifestyle of sitting around. I wanted to get back to work. I wanted to do something. And so right away they got me in connection with, I don't know how many of you remember Darlene Walker. Of course. And so she said she really wasn't qualified if I wanted to go back to work, so she assigned me to Irene Kehoe. And my life took off. She sent me to OCB. I was there for 5.5 months. I left OCB on a Thursday. On Sunday I was at guide dog school. I didn't even unpack my suitcase. I set it on the floor, left all the necessary things in it, took my winter clothes out, put my summer clothes in there for guide dog school. And my guide is over there in the corner, Ruth Ann. And I've had her now for 6 years, and she's a joy. When I got back from guide dog school, I ended up going back to the Society for the Blind for the career achievement classes. I learned how to do interviews. Learned how to do the 30-second bite to get them interested in what I had to offer. Learned all kinds of things so that I could go back to work. I volunteered. I volunteered as senior mentor for the retreats. Volunteered for hospice. Was bereavement volunteer. Did everything I could to keep busy. I didn't interview for a lot of jobs, though, because I wanted to work for the society. They gave me back my life. And I wanted to give them something. And so there just weren't any openings. So I kept on mentoring and everything. And one day I got a phone call. And we have a temporary job open. Would you like it? When do you want me? As soon as possible. I'll be there in 2 hours. And that's how I got back with them. I was the senior impact project receptionist when clients called in or I called clients and everything. And then I continued that job and it expanded into being case manager. And, you know, I just kept wanting to help and do more. And now I'm an instructor for the senior retreat. And so I feel like I can hopefully help somebody to get back their self-esteem, to help them learn how to cook. I'm the daily living skills instructor, so I help teach them, you know, how to tell a boiling pot and how to keep their fingers when they're chopping their onions. So many things. So I feel like I've gone 360 degrees. I started with the society, and I'm right back with it. And, you know, I can smile again. I can laugh. I think I'm a totally different person than I was in 2003 when my eyesight went. And, you know, the society gave me that. The senior retreat gave me that. And working with people, there was a lady that came in not too long ago. She was walking with a walker. She was only 58 years old. She was so depressed. By the time she got done, she had determined she wasn't going to use her walker again. The last day that she came to the retreat, she was walking straight. The walker was a result of her depression. She was feeling if her eyesight was leaving her, she needed a walker to guide herself, that she couldn't do anything anymore. Her 16-year-old son was worrying about her and doing everything for her. So she left with a smile. She went from the 7-day retreat to the residence retreat, and now she's one of our happiest, smilingest volunteers. And so the society not only teaches us to think outside the box and learn different ways to keep our independence, but it helps us build up our self-esteem to where it should be. Thank you. Shane?
Thank you, Ann, and thank you, Liz. So as you've heard, taking advantage of programs like those that we offer can dramatically change an individual's life. And I think each of us has personally experienced a transformation of one sort or another as we came to accept our blindness and made the decision to do something about it. And, you know, I'm thinking about the lady that Ann was just talking about. And there are many, many examples that I could talk about. I'll talk about just a couple. There was a woman a few months ago who attended our five-day residential retreat. She's 74 years old, a retired state worker. She moved into an assisted living facility a couple years ago. She felt that she was not able to take care of herself on her own at home. And so she chose that option. And she was happy with it. She liked having her meals prepared for her, liked having folks around her who could assist her in going shopping and doing other things that she needed to do. And she was okay with that. But she decided to explore the possibility of learning some skills that might help her do some things that she was struggling to do at the time. And so she went through our five-day retreat program and had an amazing experience there. She learned how to cut fruits and vegetables without cutting herself. She learned how to cook around a stove, a hot stove, without burning herself. And those had been concerns to her up to that point. And the really terrific thing about this woman was that on the final day of retreat, we always have a little graduation ceremony, and we hand out graduation certificates, and we give each client an opportunity to speak for a moment about their experiences that week. And she stood up and she talked about how much she had gained from the experience. And the really wonderful thing is that she said, you know, I realize now that I don't need to be in assisted living. What I've learned this week is I can do the things that are being done for me. And so I think I'm going to look for my own apartment. And as far as I know, she's, I haven't heard from her lately, but she's moving in that direction. She wants to live out on her own again. Yeah. Yeah. So we like when those kinds of outcomes occur as a result of the services we provide. Then I think about another woman that I know. A friend of mine asked me to call a friend of his, a woman in her late 60s who has been experiencing vision loss as a result of macular degeneration for the past several years. I called her and we spoke for a couple hours on the phone, and she told me that she was frustrated at her inability to do things that she was used to doing. She had grown depressed. She had become isolated from friends and family. She really liked playing bridge. She went to play bridge once a week. And her big concern was, she said, I can't see the cards anymore. And I'm embarrassed to tell people I can't see the cards, and yet I want to keep playing bridge. And she was so upset about this. She said, in fact, there's a bridge game on Monday, and I'm so afraid that I'm not going to be able to see the cards. And I said, well, if you weren't able to see the cards last time, do you think you'll be able to see them this time? Well, she says, I hope so. And I told her, I said, you know, there are other options. I said, we have a store at Society for the Blind that carries all kinds of aids for people who are blind or have low vision to help them do all kinds of things. And that ranges from white canes to talking watches to games and, in this case, large print playing cards with really big numbers and letters. and cards embossed in Braille. And you only need to know a little bit of Braille to use a Braille playing card, because there's only the numbers and four letters. So I told her about this, and she, you know, seemed interested. And I also told her about our programs and the services we could provide her. And she said, I gave her the name of our case manager, and she said, well, I'm going to call him on Monday. And I said, that's terrific. We'll look forward to seeing you. And you know what? I never heard from her again. I've not heard from her again. And at some point, I will follow up. But I know from experience exactly where she is in terms of her thinking. I know that despite being aware of the services that are available to her, and despite being aware that there are all kinds of folks who are blind doing all kinds of amazing things, including living independently, traveling, working, playing music and playing sports and you name it, people do it. And even being aware of that, I think a person can still be hesitant to reach that point of acceptance. And I know it was difficult for me. And it took a while. It didn't happen in one day. And acceptance isn't something that happens once and it's done and over with. I find that acceptance of my eye condition, the progressive nature of it, is something I have to practice on a regular basis. And so I hope that she will, and I think that she will, arrive at that point where she will contact us. I think she will be coming in and learning the things that she wants to learn to do the things she wants to do. I think it's just a matter of time. But gosh, I sure wish she'd do it now rather than later, because as you all, life is short and time flies. And why waste a moment when the solution is right there? And that's what we offer with the Senior Impact Project and our other programs at Society for the Blind. We provide solutions for living. And we're very proud of what we do, and we're very proud of our outcomes. So I want to give you guys an opportunity to ask questions. I don't know if any of you have any questions or if you have any topics you'd like to discuss. We do have a few minutes. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Once this meeting is concluded, is Kathleen still here?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we do have a display table up in the exhibitors hall. Is everybody familiar with that, where that is?
Yeah.
And we'd love to have you come by. We've got some literature and can talk more in depth on an individual basis if you'd like.
I think I saw your watch.
Is it still working? Good. Excellent. That's what we like to hear.
Okay.
How far is that? It's been 20 minutes.
Okay.
Yes. I have a microphone.
Could I just mention a couple of the things?
Absolutely.
Also,
please.
Does she need the mic?
Shane and Ann and Liz did a really good job overview,
but I also wanted to tell you just a little bit more in about the region that we serve. Our service region for the senior program covers about 25 counties in Northern California. So we're not just at the agency. When we talk about going into people's homes or where people live, we are reaching out into all those areas. And we have partnerships that also make that possible. In Woodland, there's a low vision support group out of sight. Some of the members are here today. We go down to Modesto, and we have another support group, another agency organization that we partner with. But we also partner with lots of retirement homes, other types of support groups, senior centers throughout Northern California, because it's really important for people to know that the services are available, the resources are available, not only through Society for the Blind, but also through lots of other agencies and opportunities in Northern California. The program was specifically designed to reach people who are 55 and older, because that's where the vision loss is happening, where we have a large percentage of folks who, for the first time in their life, are dealing with significant vision loss and blindness, and they just don't know what the resources are. So these guys are out in the field as well as providing the retreats from Sacramento. I just wanted to mention that, Shane.
You also have to educate doctors.
Yes, there's an entire community that we also reach out to, and we try to do presentations and really collaborate not only with where people are living but other types of service providers.
My doctor asked me why I was using a white cane.
Yeah.
My doctor does that too.
So in a way, you know, you're also a teacher. You're educating an individual and bringing awareness to them so that hopefully they can pass it on to the next person. So, yeah, really, you know, you're a teacher throughout your life as well as a learner, right?
Okay.
I'm interested in the funding resources. Do you receive Title VII monies and other sources of support for the senior program?
Yes, we do. Our senior impact project is currently funded by two grants. One is a federal Title VII Chapter 2 grant that we renew annually. And we also have some money currently that came from the Obama stimulus funds. And that's been very helpful in continuing our residential retreat program. We really, when we offered the residential retreats, we had an actual house in Sacramento, and we conducted our retreats at this home that we owned and that we maintained. And that was a wonderful thing. But for financial reasons, we had to give that up some years ago. So the stimulus funds have enabled us to provide the residential retreats, which for the time being we're doing at a local hotel, which has its advantages. The rooms are very nice. Folks who attend each have their own private room and bath with a shared common area and kitchen. So it's quite nice. But it's a different kind of experience when you have a home and you spend time in an environment that's more like one's own home. It's more close to what a person is used to experiencing, and in some ways is a better way to learn the skills that we teach. Other questions?
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a hand back here somewhere.
Yeah, back here.
You keep waving
at one. Okay, right here. Okay, this is Josie Conklin. I used to teach a Society for the Blind. I was a rail instructor for 20 years. But anyway, what I'd like to know is where are you teaching your basic skills with clients now? Is it at the old agency or the new?
That's a terrific question. As some of you may know, for I think 35 years or so, we operated out of a building on 24th Street.
Right.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, go ahead.
The 24th Street behind the State DMV building. But for the past 7 years or so, we have been conducting what we call our capital campaign. And this has been a fundraising effort to find and renovate a new space for us to operate, because our programs have grown and continue to grow. So we needed some growing room. And thanks to a lot of donations of both labor and materials and operating funds, we have a brand new building now. And we moved in there a year ago in March. The building is in downtown Sacramento on S and 13th Streets. It's a beautiful space. It gives us the room we need to operate all the programs that we operate. And again, our senior impact program that we focus on today is just one program. We also have a low vision clinic where we evaluate clients determine what the best optical aids might be for them to continue using the sight that they have. We have an access news program which provides news and all kinds of information over the phone, and it's completely free. Even grocery ads are on the Access News program. So a person who can't read the newspaper can listen to the daily specials by just calling a phone number.
Okay, so you don't use the old building any no longer?
We use the old building.
Oh, you're still there with some services?
Yes.
Okay.
We use the old building to operate the Senior Impact Project. That's where most of our instruction takes place for our seven-day day retreat.
Okay, that'd be, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other
questions?
We've got a microphone. Can I say something?
Certainly.
I'm Don Wilcox, and I, with Roger, we run the health library for all of you, for all over California. I'm a registered nurse, and I keep my license up because of this, even though I'm very old. So,
you don't sound older.
I know, but I am. So, anyway, we have a whole bunch of stuff. And Roger's a really good sport when I boss him around. But we have a whole bunch of things that we can give you. I have some of them here. We have a CD that has the entire library on it, which we learned how to burn a CD. And we learned how to do an MP3. And so I've got some of those, but I don't know anymore what people have at home to read these things with. You know, life, it keeps changing. But I have that, and I have large print, and we're also running research lists that takes most of my time. I'm running one for diabetics, any kind of diabetics, one on glaucoma, which is my favorite disease, and what the big one is the AMD retina. There's a lot of people on that. So everything that I can get access to, medically wise, I put it into a summary, unless they've already done that. You wouldn't believe some of these guys that write a 65-page paper, and I come down to the bottom of reading it with window eyes and large print, come down, and they really don't have a good conclusion. I could kill them. But anyway, I put this stuff in there, and I put it out once a month. So anybody can have any of that, because Roger and I are volunteers at VISTA. And VISTA is sort of like the society, only we're covering, we don't have near 25 counties. How many do we have, Roger? From the San Francisco line down to that San Mateo County, Santa Clara. Yeah. So we're going down that direction, and we do all the services in the home. We don't have this wonderful retreat thing. A few years ago, I was up here. I saw that house. I thought, what a beautiful place to learn all. And I thought, how can they afford it?
So, turned out they couldn't.
One of the things I wanted to say about the 25 counties is when you think about northeastern California, how many of you have ever been to northeastern California? It's pretty remote and rural. So getting services to folks who live out in probably what's mostly a rural service region is the opportunity to have a grant and have funding that allows us to either go to those folks, which obviously you're not going to see too many people in one place, or to go get those folks and bring them to Sacramento and allow them the opportunity to really immerse themselves in the training so that when they go back to their communities, they're going back as advocates as well. They're going to spread the word in their community that, no, just because you lose your vision, life isn't over. You're just going to start thinking outside the box and doing things a little bit differently. So primarily, we do reach out into very rural counties. Oh, absolutely. Let me bring the mic.
Reach in front of you.
There
you go, Mary. My name is Marion Tucker, and I'm from the Out of Sight Group in Woodland. And I would like to know if you have a... I'm pretty sure you teach Braille. Can you tell me what the charge for that is, and do you provide transportation?
Do you want to address that, Jane?
Yes. We do teach Braille at Society, and we teach Braille, a little basic Braille, in our retreat programs, and we can even teach Braille in our in-home programs. For seniors 55 and over, those services are free because they're funded by the federal grants that we mentioned. So,
There are other options. The State Department of Rehabilitation is whose mission it is to help individuals who are blind or have low vision to become employed again. Persons who become clients of the Department of Rehabilitation are eligible for our instructional services, and that's another way to learn Braille and learn other skills that interest you. All it requires is expressing an interest in returning to work. So that's not an option for everyone, but it is one of them.
It's the Hadley School.
Yes, Hadley?
Hadley School for the Blind in Illinois. It's a correspondence school.
Yes.
They teach Braille, too. I think we're out of time.
Yes, we are out of time. I thank everyone for being here today and participating. We're very glad to have had the opportunity to be here ourselves, and we are going to be around for a few minutes afterwards. So if any of you have additional questions, feel free to come on up front and talk to any of us, and we'll do our best to answer. So thanks to everyone, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Okay, yeah, well, maybe we can, maybe if you guys want to talk to each other, maybe you guys want to talk to each other, you can do it at the back, because I think we have another program. Is Terry Becker here?
Yes, I am.
Okay, yeah, we have another item here on the program, so I can't let you come up here and talk for unlimited amount of time. Can't do that. But you could do it outside the door, or you could, you know, whatever. But we want to continue on with the program. I want to thank the folks from the Society for the Blind. It sounds like a really good program. And talking about the 25 counties, I was just, you know, the librarian, I talked to the librarian yesterday, Sacramento, Mike Marlin, and he says they do 48 counties, and it's an odd thing about California that, you know, that there are 48 counties in the Northern California, and there are 10 in Southern California. They got Riverside and San Bernardino are immense, and so it's San Diego County and so on. So it's kind of strange the way California is built. I haven't had a chance to meet Terry Becker, but we're going to all meet her now. Terry Becker is director of something called the TLC program, which is a telephone reassurance program operated by Escaton. And she's going to tell us what Escaton is, because I don't know. As I shared with the folks, and I'm learning to talk like Donna, I shared with, you know, with the folks at the beginning, I am a member of the Senior Advisory Committee in the city of Mountain View, and one of the things we talk about a lot is aging in place. And I think that means that you get to, as you age, you still get to live where you want to live and do what you want to do, and you don't have to go into an institution or whatever. Your decisions don't have to be made on the basis of your age. And you can have the services that you need, stay at home, your home, or whatever you want to do. And one of those things, of course, for folks who live by themselves and everything, is the concept of telephone reassurance and just keeping in touch. And some people can do that with friends and family and so forth, and others don't have friends and family real handy, or maybe they don't like their friends and family. I don't know. There is a need for telephone reassurance. And so Bonnie Rennie, who was supposed to be here to do this session, invited Terry Becker to come and talk about the TLC program, and I propose to give her the mic right now and let her do it.
Thank you all very much. I'm honored to be here. I'm learning a lot. I sat through this last session. Okay, well, my name is Terry Becker, and I'm with Eschaton, which is located in Carmichael, California. Can I get a, by show of hands, how many people live in the greater Sacramento area?
In Carmichael.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Because a lot of those folks, if you're out of town, from out of town, you might not be familiar with Eschaton. Eschaton provides senior residences and services, and we're primarily located in the Sacramento area, but we all also have some facilities in Northern California. What most people know Eschaton is having some high-income type facilities, a little bit expensive residences. But what most people don't know, we have a well-kept secret. We have more affordable housing units in the greater Northern California than we do the high-income levels. Yeah, see, didn't even know that you're in Carmichael. And like Roger said, you know, it's all about aging. Everybody wants to stay in their own home for as long as possible. That's where we feel most comfortable, and that's where we want to stay forever. And even though Eschaton offers residences, and these residences I'm talking about, some of their facilities have multi-level care. They could have an independent area. They could have assisted living. They could have skilled nursing facilities, and they could have memory care. Some of them might just have assisted and memory care. Some of them, we have three skilled nursing facilities, and that's all they offer, rehabilitation. And then we have our almost 20 affordable housing units located here in Sacramento and in Northern California. We're kind of going out towards the Bay Area now, too. But my program, TLC, is a telephone reassurance and home visiting program. And it's one of the outreach programs Eschaton offers. We have several. We have what we call the Senior Connection, and it's an information and assistance program. We have a care management program, which it is a fee for that. We have a transportation program, which has a fee for that. We offer community education classes. Some of those are free, and some of them have a fee on them. But what I'm here to talk to you today about is the Telephone Reassurance and Home Visiting Program. You know, I'm sorry to say, but like I said, I sat in this last session before me, and I heard about a lot from the Society for the Blind. I used to work with Regina Brink from Society for the Blind. We were both on a DOVIA board. It's Directors of Volunteers and Agencies. So I knew her, but I really have not been around or know that many people that have lost their sight or are blind, so I apologize for that if I can't relate to you very well. But what I heard in the presentation a lot was talking about depression and how hard it is when you lose your driver's license. And we hear that every day with the seniors we talk to. But when you lose your sight, anytime you have a loss of any kind, there's going to be a little bit of depression. What our program is, a telephone reassurance program, we call over 520 seniors every single day. These are seniors that still live in their own home. That's where they want to stay. But they, some of them, majority of them, live alone. Some of them still might be married. Some of them might live with their adult children. And a couple even live in an assisted living program. But primarily they're by themselves. Even if they have family members, that family member might not come around or check in on them or even call them for several weeks goes by without hearing from them. And some of them have very supportive family members, and that they are very lucky to have that. And also some of them might have family members that live out of town or out of state, or they have passed on. So they really don't have anybody anymore. And that's where we come in. We make a daily phone call to them every single day if they would like, 7 days a week. We check in on them. It's a social call. It's like calling a best friend. We continue the conversation that we had with you the day before. We just continue that conversation. We get to know their family, their grandkids, their adult children. And the difference is they get to vent to us. We all need somebody to vent to about our husbands or our wives or, you know, our kids, you know, and everything. But that's where we come in. We just let them vent to us. We listen. We talk to them. They get to know our grandkids. They know who my grandkids are. They, my children. We kind of grow up with each other. And we go through a lot of sorrows together, too, whether they lose a pet or they lose their spouse or their child died or something, or something else happens. We go through that with them too. But most of all, these phone calls are upbeat, friendly. We reminisce a lot. I can tell you, as volunteers that come into our program, we have over 170 volunteers that help us make these calls. We learn a lot from, as you know, the older populations have wonderful stories. They have histories, things that they have gone through. They need to share these things. And we need to take that in. We need to learn from them, and we do that. So the phone calls can last anywhere from 5 minutes to a half an hour to 45 minutes. There's no limit on the phone calls. Also, when we're on the phone with them, we kind of do a mini welfare check. During the summertime, we make sure their air conditioner's working. And in the wintertime, we make sure their heat's working. We ask them if they have enough food. A lot of the majority of the seniors that we call are living off of Social Security. And most of that is $700-$800 a month. It doesn't go very far. So we want to make sure they have food. And when we ask these questions, if their air conditioning is not working, we have resources out there. We work with SMUD and PG&E very closely. SMUD has portable swamp coolers that they'll bring into that home and let that person use for as long as they need to. We call PG&E if they need to come out and check the pilot light, see if it needs to be lit. We work hand in hand with Meals on Wheels through Asian Community Center. We just hooked up just recently. I'm doing a volunteer program with Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services, which is a wonderful program. They wanted to do something for seniors too, so they've got volunteers that want to do something with seniors. We've got the seniors in our program, and we've got the experience in teaching volunteers how to communicate and teach or talk with seniors. So we're providing the training for the volunteers. But when they go out and visit that senior, their volunteers go out and visit that senior one time a month, they're bringing them a box of fresh fruits and vegetables and canned goods. So they get a little benefit of food too. And, you know, we can bring them as much as we can, but that visit that they get from somebody is a gift off that companionship that they have. And it's intergenerational. The families that are visiting the seniors within the food bank program are bringing their children with them too. So it's a win-win for the younger generation, and it's a win-win for the older generation too. But going back to the telephone reassurance program, anybody is eligible to sign up for this program. We said 60 years of age, but I can tell you we have several 50-year-olds and a couple of 40-year-olds that are on our program because they are disabled and homebound, and they need just as much social interaction or companionship does because they are homebound. They're staying at home. The service is totally free. Does not a fee or a cost to anybody. It's basically volunteer run. I have a very small staff. I'm the director, and I have three part-time and one full-time person with me. And we oversee the 500 seniors and the 100 and some odd volunteers. And there's more volunteers during the holiday season because we do a gift delivery during the holiday season to our seniors too. We try and do reminiscence over the phone. We try to capture those stories. We just had a lady, neat story. She loves to garden. We had a Sacramento Rotary Breakfast Club want to do a project. They wanted to do yard cleanup. So they called us and said, do you have anybody that could use a yard cleanup? So we identified about three folks. They did drive-bys. They picked this one lady, Elaine, and she doesn't have a front yard with lawn in it. She has a front yard with flowers and plants. And it's just overwhelming for her. She couldn't go out there and pull all the weeds all the time. So this group of volunteers from the Rotary group came out one Saturday, pulled all the weeds. She had a shed in the backyard that was still in a box. She needed it built. They went out there and they built that shed for her in the backyard. But one thing that she does, she loves to garden. She loves to share things with her. So what she does, she starts things from seed or takes a succulent and sticks it in the dirt so it grows another plant. And she'll sell those as part of an income for her. But she also teaches the children in the neighborhood how to garden. So they just stop by her front yard, and she's out there with a couple of tables out in her front yard, and she'll show them how to plant a plant and water it and all this stuff. And one of the volunteers that was in the office was talking to her, and she said, well, you know, I've got several pots in my garage that I don't garden much anymore, and I'd be happy to give them to you. So my staff member took those pots to her the same day they were doing the yard cleanup, and she was just grateful. You know, we don't just buy food. If we find stories like that, and if they want to do something or have a story or a need, we'll try and accommodate them. The other thing I want to tell you that's not so great about her, she has a male friend. He does not live with her, but he has become her friend. He took her places to the store and different things like that. She just recently learned that he's a felon and he's out on parole. She is very scared, not to say the least. She is very, very scared. So one of the other staff in the office went out and visited her yesterday because we wanted to get some pictures of her because we're doing a story here regarding the gardening part. And she is so scared. She's actually contacted the police, and they're very much aware of the situation. But the gentleman has keys to her home. Yeah. So we, the TLC program, are paying for new locks on all of her doors and changing those locks. And we're working with Rebuilding Together to go out and do that. So when we hear things like that, we want to take care, because the most important thing is to be safe in your own home. And, you know, she can't feel safe if she knows this gentleman's there. Not that he's going to do anything, but you never know. You just never know. And there's been other stories I can tell you. There was a gentleman that we were calling every day, and it was just unusual. We didn't reach him one day, and he lived in a mobile home park. We called his emergency contact, which is a friend. The friend went and checked on him. The paper was still on the front porch, which is never a good sign. The dog that he had was barking inside, and he couldn't unlock the door, so we had to call police, and the police went out and obviously got in the house. And his name was Fred, and he had passed away overnight in his own bed. But Skippy was his dog, and Skippy would not let anybody near Fred at all. So they had to call the animal control and get Skippy out of there so they could take Fred, and we notified the family that, you know, he had been found. Well, Skippy was his companion the whole time. Skippy and Fred knew everybody in that mobile home park because they went on walks every day. And Skippy meant the world to Fred. So his family, Fred's family, lived up, I think, in Washington or Oregon and couldn't get down. So they took Skippy to the pound, and they hold them there. I guess if somebody dies, they hold them there for like 2 weeks until a family member or somebody can come and claim them. Well, the family member didn't want them because they lived up north. So silly me, I took my daughter and myself, went down to the pound. And, of course, you just fall in love with the dog. So we end up adopting Skippy. Yeah. And at that time, Dad, I lived with him because I was his caregiver. He's passed on since then. But because my dad and Fred were pretty much the same age and didn't move much, sat in the recliners all day, Skippy was very happy just laying at the feet of my dad. So, yeah. So Skippy had to be put down, too, because after a few years, he's been having seizures. But he had a good life, I think. So it's more than just phone. That's why I'm trying to get the point across. It's more than phone calls. We really get to know these people and care about them a lot. And just to tell you a little bit how the program works, if somebody were to sign up for our program, they would fill out a very simple application. We would call them and ask them what time of day they would like to receive calls and what days of the week. You can do it 7 days a week, but some people only sign up for 4 days a week or five because they might be going to a senior center regular day or adult day health care, or they go to dialysis or something else. And we have one lady that has a standing appointment every Friday with her beautician. So as long as we know that that person is being touched by someone else on other days of the week, we might not call them on that day. But you can sign up for 7 days a week. We call as early as 8 a.m, and we'd like to finish our calls, at least initially the calls, by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But we are making calls, I can tell you, till 5 o'clock a day every time before I leave. At 5 o'clock, if we don't reach that person during the day, by 2 o'clock we start contacting their emergency contacts, which could be a neighbor or a friend or a family member, and say, hey, you know, we haven't been able to reach her today. Have you seen her? And they say, oh yeah, she's sitting right next to me. We went out shopping today, or she had a doctor's appointment. And so we know somebody else knows where they're at and that they're okay. After a certain amount of time, if we can't reach them or their emergency contacts, we will call the sheriff or the police to go out and do a welfare check. And sometimes it's just they couldn't hear the phone. They stepped away from it. They're sleeping. Maybe they're taking some medications that have made them drowsy. A couple of times we have found them where they have fallen and that police goes out there, gets an ambulance out there and picks them up and checks them out. And a couple times, unfortunately, too, we have found they have passed away. But that's what it's about. And I can't tell you, so many apartment complexes have called us, said, you know, we had a gentleman in the apartment that had passed away, and they don't have any checkup or things in their an apartment complex. Nobody checks on anybody. And he'd been in the apartment room for 3 or 4 days. And when other people that lived in the apartment complex found that out, they all started getting worried. So they called us and said, you know, we don't want that to happen to us, and we don't either, you know. So that's what it's all about. It's just making sure somebody is touched every single day. We have about 21 of our seniors that don't want the conversation. They don't need the socialization. But they want peace of mind knowing that somebody else has checked on that day. So what they do, they call in to us. We have a 24-hour message line that anybody can call in to us and leave us a message. And Sue Smith will call in and say, I'm calling in today. I'm fine. Talk to you guys tomorrow. And we'll check her off in our book. Know that she's okay, but if she doesn't call us, we darn sure will call her. But it just gives them peace of mind knowing that somebody else out there in the world knows that they woke up that next day. That's all it takes. It's just a little connection there. The referrals, how we get most of the people on our program is from Adult Protective Services. Not that they have been abused, but because of neglect, they just at a point in their life, they cannot take care of themselves anymore. So APS will come into their situation. They'll set us up as far as daily phone calls. They might set up Meals on Wheels so they get some food coming in. And they'll set up, if the funds are still there, in-home support services, and whatever else they can do. But they know that we will be there touching them every day. And if we see or hear something from the senior that something's just not right, what we do is we also contact that social worker that signed them up with us, and we'll go back and say, this is what we're seeing again. Maybe you need to go back and recheck on them again. It's very seldom we ever turn anybody down at all. The other referral sources are discharge planners at hospitals, senior centers, dialysis centers. It could be an adult child that has come in for a visit and they live out of state and say, oh my gosh, I didn't know mom or dad's situation was this bad. We got to set things in place. So they start looking for agencies in the community, and we're one of them. And we will call that adult child out of state or out of town to let them progress if that's what they want. And they know too that they can always call us to see, hey, have you been calling mom? How's she sounding? You know, is there anything different? And sometimes a senior themselves will self-refer because they say, my neighbor's getting this phone call and I want to get a call too. Or they worry about their pets. They say, you know, if I die in my bed or something, who's going to take care of my cat? Who's going to feed my dog? So that is a real, you know, that's their family. That's their little person that's in their household with them all the time. So it means a lot to them to know that their pet's going to be okay. Like I said, we don't really turn anybody down at all. Calls are very easy to do. We set them up immediately. We do offer home visits. The home visits are a little bit different. We don't have as many home visitor volunteers as we do telephone volunteers. So if somebody wants a home visitor, we take their name, we'll still make calls to them, and when we get a volunteer that lives kind of in that same neighborhood or zip code area, if that volunteer wants to do a home visit, we'll ask that senior, would you like to have somebody come visit you? And most of the time they do. So we set those two people up. The home visits are not scheduled with us. That's between that volunteer and that senior as to what days or what times they would like those visits. It could be in the weekends. It could be in the evenings. And they, not just the telephone volunteers, but the home visitor volunteers, they develop wonderful relationships with the seniors. They sometimes end up inviting them to their home for the holidays. They'll take them out to lunch. They might even help them with shopping. And that's perfectly okay. It's not a requirement of our volunteers, but it's okay if that's what the volunteer wants to do. Our volunteers, they sign up. They go through a lengthy orientation. We do take a copy of their driver's license and proof of insurance. Not that they're going to drive anybody, but just in case they do that. And also gives us a picture idea of who that person is. We know that they are who they say they are. Also, any volunteers that are going into our seniors' homes, we do fingerprints on them through the Department of Justice. We make sure that they are a good person. And we haven't had anybody. Most people, that when they want to volunteer like this, they're doing it for the right reason. You know, they've had a parent or a grandparent that's passed on. They really want to get back involved with a senior. They have a passion for seniors. And so most times we don't have any problems with any of our volunteers at all. And like I mentioned earlier in the presentation, I was listening to find a lot of this is about depression. If an individual has lost their driver's license, maybe doesn't have any family, and they're living at home primarily by themselves, four walls every single day with maybe only a television for entertainment, you can imagine how depressing that could be. As we all know, depression can live to other, lead to other chronic diseases. So if a simple phone call can make a difference in somebody's life, makes them healthier, we're right there for them. The other thing we try and do, if we have any seniors on our program that are still pretty much with it, we do have some with dementia, and some other issues, but if they're still pretty much with it, we'll turn them into a volunteer. And yes, ma'am. Yes, we do. No, I'm sorry, I didn't clarify that. We have Yolo County, Sacramento County, Placer, El Dorado, Nevada County. I just had one lady, she was on our calls yesterday, and the volunteer stopped me. He says, can we make a phone call to Bakersfield? And I said, heck yeah. She's our regular client. She's moving to Bakersfield, and we will make a phone call to her. We don't do a whole lot of them, but we will, because when somebody moves, that's a big change for them. You know, they might be moving to live closer to their adult children, but they don't know anybody there. So if we continue to keep this relationship with them and help them adjust into their new living situation, we will, yeah, we'll do that.
What about, again, reiterate about there's no cost?
No cost. Eschaton is a nonprofit organization, but, like I said, we are one of the outreach programs for Eschaton in addition to the senior information and assistance and the classes and all this other stuff.
Those are just costs of doing business.
Correct. Give back to the community. Exactly. So Eschaton pays the small staff that we have for this. Like I said, it's mostly volunteer run based on volunteers. We do get some money. We don't go for any federal, county, or state funding because we have seen what can happen to that. We might lose it. We have a wonderful foundation that also gives us some money for special projects and things like that. We even have some money that with that transportation program I told you about called Companionship Plus, there is a fee for that. But our foundation has given us some money for the folks on the TLC program that are low income. If they need to get to a doctor's appointment or to a grocery store, that's very vital. We will pay for that ride and hopefully the person, we only ask $5 for that ride. The rides usually last about 2 hours. But our foundation basically has subsidized that ride for us to offer that to them. I always say a healthy senior is a healthy economy, and a healthy economy is a healthy senior. It's what?
It gets us out.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Go ahead. Yes, ma'am. I have flyers. I was told our brochures are small to read, but I have an 18-font flyer if anybody would like to take this with them. Okay, and I have several. I have a whole bunch of handouts here. This program, the TLC program, actually started with St. Paul's Episcopal Church in downtown Sacramento in 1968. Yeah. It started with just a few women there that were noticing there were a lot of seniors within the neighborhood that maybe came into the church, but they thought those seniors might need a little bit more visits or attention. So that's how it started with St. Paul's Episcopal Church. They lost their funding, and one of the founders of that program there knew John Burrow at the time, who was our CEO at Eschaton, and thought it would be a wonderful collaboration, something, a service that Eschaton could offer. So we took it on. It's been with us now for 14 years. Made a lot of changes. It's grown. They only had about 200 and some, so now we've got over 500 And, you know, we know we're just touching the tip of the iceberg as far as the number of seniors out there, but I keep telling my boss, unless you give me some more staff, I really can't expand the number of people, because I want to give quality service, and or I've got to really get on the ball and get more volunteers. And let me tell you about the volunteers. We have a very small little call center in our office, which I have about 12 to 15 volunteers that come in throughout the week, different days each week to help us make the calls. But I also have over 100 volunteers that call from their home. Yes, and that's a good point. Most of the volunteers that call from their home are seniors themselves. That generation still want to volunteer. They can't drive, they can't get out, but they can surely make a phone call.
A lot of our visually impaired people can do that.
Exactly. That's what I was hoping to hear. Yeah, exactly. So the volunteers that call from their home, they're matched up with anywhere from 1 to 3 people or more. Just depends on how much time they have to donate. And then once they talk to those certain people on the days that they're supposed to call, then they call into us on that 24-hour message line, and they just leave us a message saying, hey, this is Sue. I called my lady today, and everybody's fine. And Sue has a chart. We check off all her people, make sure everybody's fine. And like I said, the volunteers can tell us, I only want to call Monday through Friday. I only want to call on Saturday and Sunday. I only want to call Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. So we'll match them with somebody that wants calls on those days too. So we try and accommodate everybody. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, just out of curiosity, there was a hospital in Coosa by the name of Espeton. Is there any relationship between that?
No. From what I understand, if I can think back, Escaton actually started in the Bay Area in Oakland. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with American River Hospital that used to be on Ingle Avenue. That was an Escaton, American River Hospital. And at that time, many years ago, Escaton had, I thought, pretty good vision. They got out of the hospital business. They saw that more people were going to be going into skilled facilities, so that's what they started opening up. And the multi-level of care housing, because as you know, if you go in the hospital, they get you out of there as soon as they can. They send you back home, they send you the skilled facilities, whatever.
Surgery.
Yeah.
Is it necessary to do background checks on your volunteers?
Yes, we do background checks. Yes, we do.
That's a good
thing, yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And in fact, with the Sacramento Food Bank, the program I was telling you about earlier, because children now, most of our volunteers that visit are adults. But if there's a child going into the home and visiting, we are now doing, what is that law, to check against predators, against children? Megan's Law. Thank you. Megan's Law. So for the food bank, what I will be checking going into the Megan's Law to see if, not that I think any of our seniors are predators, but you just never know. Got to be safe and sorry. Or they might have an adult child that could be a predator living in that same home. So with this children now going into the home, we will do the Megan's Law check on them also for that one particular program. We are trying to expand the number of volunteers that we have for helping us make phone calls. It would be nice if every single senior had a buddy phone caller, you know, that they had that relationship one-on-one, even though people in the office that call, they have certain people they like to call, and the ones that they call, I only want to talk to Helen. Helen's a little 4'5" person that comes in. She's 83-year-olds and volunteers for us 4 days a week, and they just love talking to her. We have one man in our office. A lot of ladies love to talk to the man. They don't want to talk to the women. Yeah. 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 More women, as you know, but we do have a few men. They're very popular if we get them on our program to volunteer. Let's see. What else do we do? We have, like I said, during the holidays, we did a giving tree, and we had to change it this year because we just moved into a new location. It's much smaller. But what we did before, we asked every single one of our seniors, all 500, what they wanted for the holidays, because a lot of them don't get gifts at all. This might be the only gift that they get is from us. And what they asked for, nothing big. They asked for pajamas or slippers or robes or I need an electric blanket. I would really like a food basket. So we have about 30 different companies around, businesses around town, that their employees have a giving tree. And we had the request from the senior on a little tree, not their last name, just their first name. And the employees would pull off a mitten off this tree and purchase the gift, and they would wrap it, and they would all come back to our office. Then I'd have over 100 volunteers that would come in and deliver those gifts to all the seniors. And the delivery was a gift in itself. That's why I said the visit or a gift to this senior is the visit that they get from the volunteers that actually deliver the gifts. Sometimes they'll stay with them for 2 hours, just sitting there and talking to them or watching a movie with them. They'll bring their kids with them. The kids will sing Christmas carols, or they might have made a little batch of cookies for them before they went. And then we work with Bridges After School Program, which is with the San Juan Unified School District's After School Program. These kids can make the cutest Christmas cards ever. They have like little stick Santa Clauses with a big belly sticking out, a little stick and a little hat, and they decorate, and they're just precious, and the seniors love that. So this last year, I got a call or a letter back from one of our seniors, his wife and him, and he said, you know, I love the card that the kids sent. He said, I would really like to be a pen pal if any of those kids want to write to me. So I called the school, and we've got now 70 seniors that want to be pen pals in 3 schools that want to write letters back and forth to each other. So that's another program we got to start up. We got to figure out how we're going to coordinate, because I can't give the seniors the kids' addresses, and I can't give the kids the seniors' address. Yeah, so it's all going to come into our office, so we kind of be like a clearinghouse in a sense. So that's another project, that's intergenerational, but it's just... And a lot of our seniors would say, you know, I'd really like to, but my handwriting is just terrible now. And I'm thinking, have you seen some of these elementary kids' handwriting? You know, they don't have any better handwriting than you do. So, yeah. But it's just a neat thing to see the different generations coming together.
Have you cloned your project at all? Do you ever provide any other groups information to start?
But I love this guy. He just leads right into everything I'm doing. Let me just answer this one question first. We do have a project I'm working on called TLC in a Box. And we have gotten calls. If you go on the internet and you Google or you just type in telephone reassurance, our name pop up. And I get calls. I have gotten a call from Florida, from Maine, New Hampshire, all over the United States saying, how do you do this program? And we have been working on this for a while, but funding is an issue. And we actually had a really neat computer guy put this program in the system for us. And we're trying to get enough money to get it on a website. We don't want anybody to have to sit there and reinvent this wheel. We think we've got it down pretty good. Any community, once we get this out and about, can offer this to their community. And when I say community, it could be a church. It could be a community like Rancho Murrieta. It could be, since we are up in Northern California, if you've ever heard of Hayfork, which is you go up to Reading and you make a left, you know, it's really remote. That facility up there wanted to actually start a telephone reassurance because the 36 people that live in our facility in Hayfork know of other neighbors that live around that area. It's all foothill type areas that are still living by themselves, and they wanted to start their own telephone reassurance program there too. So, with the ones I gotten from the East Coast, it's mostly been senior centers. Asked, how do you do this? You know, we've got people coming in. One example, this weather around here has been crazy this last year, and it was in Maine, and they were having such horrible snowstorms. The seniors could not come into the senior center for several weeks or a day, you know, at a time. And they said, you know, we never thought about having a telephone reassurance program because they're all in here all the time, but how do we check in on them when they can't come in? So now they have the idea we need to start up a telephone reassurance program. So yes, we are trying to put it in a package that we can just hand out to them and say, hey, do this. You know, they can do it as big as they want. I know Placer County and El Dorado County has a very similar telephone reassurance home visiting program, much smaller scale that run actually through the county. They might call maybe 40 or 50 people. So it can be done, but like I said, again, don't reinvent the wheel. You know, we can definitely help them. And until we get our box together, I send people all the tools that I have, all the forms that we use, instructions that I have to help them get it started, at least get that wheel going where they can start thinking about it and doing their own. I have one question. There's a lady here. One more question. Can I ask her?
Okay.
You had a question.
I just wondered if you had an
800
number.
Yes. It's on the flyer. I did not put my 800 number on there, but I do. Okay. The 800 number, I can give that to you. And I have brochures, our fancy brochures, that you can take with you. Maybe you have a reader that can help you magnify this. The toll-free number I will give to you right now, if you can write it down, it's 1-888-334-3490. You're welcome. And we're on the web. It's www.eschaton.org, but that's on the flyer, too. My name is on the flyer. If you want to call me Monday or any time next week and just talk to me further, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Eschaton is E-S-K-A-T-O-N.
Yes. Yes, it is. And I did bring some applications for services and some volunteer applications. I will leave those here, and you guys can pick them up if you'd like them. Their applications are also available on their website. You can go in there and download them. Okay. Yeah, okay, okay. Thank you guys very, very much. Yes. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank
I did enjoy
care.
This very, very much. Thank you.
I want to welcome everyone to the second portion of the Seniors with Vision Loss program and the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. I know I'm not going to get this right, Roger. This portion. I'm Bernice Kandarian, President of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision, and this section is called A History of Blind Organization and the Changing Imperatives of Advocacy. And to that end, we have it will be a conversation with Steve Mendelson and Peterson. Steve is an attorney, and he spoke with us at the last convention about health care. And the airline information. Before I make a bigger mess, let me turn it over to Roger and Steve.
Welcome them.
So now I've taken off my moderator's hat and put on my program participant's hat here. Don't you think it becomes me?
Let me give the disclaimer. Let me have that microphone. I was asked to give a disclaimer that the views that will be expressed here are not necessarily those of the California Council of the Blind.
The views I express are never anybody else's views except my own.
Not necessarily even my own.
That's right. You know how these lawyers are. They'll say anything to, you know.
Come on, yeah.
So Steve and I talked a little bit about, you know, what the conversations that we're hearing in the organization about how things have changed. There are a lot of us in this organization who've been around a long time. I've been to 30 some odd ACB conventions without missing any. And I don't know, I haven't counted how many CCB conventions I've been to. They come twice a year, so they mount up fast. But, you know, people say, like we hear one of the people we talk to a lot, Bernice and I talk to a lot, is Kathy Skivers, and a lot of you know her. She used to be president of this organization, and she's more than, 60-year member of it or something like that. And she says, well, the blind just used to go to the legislature and get bills passed right and left, you know, 22, 23, 25 bills a year. And we used to have this, and we used to have that, and we don't have it anymore, and so on and so on. And they're the blind, and then there are those other pesky people that aren't blind but have other disabilities, and then there are people who don't have any disabilities trying to horn in on our piece of the pie. So anyway, Steve and I are trying to figure out exactly what's going on, or give you some things to talk about and think about what's going on. And my motivation is that, in addition to being second vice president of California Council of the Blind, I'm also on the board of an independent living center. And it seems as though there's a little friction here and there between independent living, the independent living folks and the blindness folks. And I've been trying to figure out how I can maybe intervene on that to some degree, because I can see biases on both sides. So, I'm Roger Peterson, second vice president of California Council of the Blind, and I will now give the microphone to Steve Mendelson to make introductory remarks.
Thank you, Roger, and good morning, everyone, and thank you all for being here with us today. We understand this is billed as a discussion between the two of us, but we really hope that it'll be a discussion among all of us, and that all of you here will feel free to participate, and we feel motivated to participate, because we want you to go away with not merely more to think about, maybe having heard some things that you agree with and certain things that you disagree with, but also things that you can act upon and that you've been able to sort of help process by your own participation. So with that said, I guess we can begin the discussion where Roger has brought us so far by suggesting that there are a couple of theories about what's different in the challenges of advocacy today compared to 10, 20, 30, 40, or 50 years ago. And it's certainly true that from the standpoint of the CCB lobbying activities, I don't know if it's proper to use the word lobbying, but I think I'll use it in a figurative sense, not in a literal sense. In the context of CCB's legislative educational activities, we certainly do have fewer bills to show for our efforts at the end of any given year than we typically did 40 or 50 years ago. Now, why is that? Well, there are probably a lot of reasons. Some of them are conjectural, some of them are debatable, but some of them are not debatable and hold important lessons and implications for what we need to do in the future. And if there's anything that I want to stress, it's that all the rights we've won are, to some extent, artifacts of the kind of middle-class society that we inherited after World War II and that most of us have grown up in. All of them are now at risk to an extent that would have been unimaginable to any of us only a few years ago. And that is going to call forth from us efforts that are equal in a certain sense in terms of the intensity and engagement to the kind of efforts that were necessary during a period like World War II or other periods of crisis in our country. There's no question we're in a social crisis of unprecedented dimensions, and maybe we'll talk about that and maybe we won't, but it's a backdrop that we cannot escape. So, as Roger suggests, there is certainly some division in the views of members of the advocacy community who we hope would work together and would support each other in efforts for the good. But, of course, there's not always a definition or an agreement about what the common good is. We'll talk about that. There are changes in what the legislature does. There are changes in the locus of decision-making about key government actions or inactions. We'll talk about that. And there are also key changes in society's attitudes. The era of legislation that I call the noblesse oblige era has given rise to the resentment and bitterness era. So we'll talk about all those things. Now I'll turn it back to Roger to begin that very discussion.
You know, when you just talk about noblesse oblige, I think about back in the early 90s, I took a trip to Japan. I got to go to be there for a conference. And I discovered that the Canon company, you know, the company that makes the printers and the cameras and all that stuff, hosted us for this conference. They paid the whole price of the conference. And I discovered that companies in Japan like Canon have what Canon calls a corporate welfare division, a division which is there to give back to the community. It's not expected to make money. It's expected to lose money. And, you know, at that time I worked at Telesensory, the company here that made the Opticon and a bunch of other stuff for blind people. Canon was the distributor in Japan and in Asia for Opticons, for Telesensory's equipment. And though they were not a non-profit organization or whatever, this part of Canon functioned as if it were. And so that whole concept that if you do well in society, if you make a lot of money or whatever, you owe something back to the society is dead. There are still a lot of people, a lot of corporations, and a lot of people who give a lot of money and who do a lot of good things. But I think it is certainly changing. And one of the things I was talking with Steve about that I wanted to bring up is the concept of rights. People are, entitlement is a dirty word now. People say it's the entitlement society that's all the problem. That's why everybody expects to be entitled to things. And that's why we're spending too much money and we have a big deficit and everything. And I wanted Steve to explain to me and to everyone this concept of positive and negative rights and what that means.
Well, it's a very interesting concept, Roger. Thank you for the opportunity. I often think of positive rights, that is, we have a right to eat, a right to housing, a right to a certain amount of warmth. Obviously, we think we have a right to medical care. These are our moral rights. They're social rights. Sometimes they're legal rights to the degree that they're embodied in statutes. If you think about Medicare or Medicaid or CHIP, Medi-Cal here, other programs, people who meet the eligibility criteria for those programs are entitled to them as a matter of law. But fundamentally, those are not based upon any constitutional rights. There's no constitutional right to medical care. There's no constitutional right to anything. There is a certain constitutional right to be treated equally to other people. But if other people have no right to anything, then equal treatment means you don't get it either. That's exactly right. And in fact, this has been an argument. What do I, as a person with a disability, as a blind person, want? Do I want the right to lead the same miserable life of every other post-middle class person? Or do I want something better? What constitutes equality? That's a very good question. What Roger was alluding to, I believe, is the fact that if you look at the Constitution, for example, the Bill of Rights, it doesn't say you have a right to free speech, although we commonly think of it that way. It says the federal government, and now the states, shall not do anything to abridge the right to free speech. It doesn't say you have a right to other freedom of the press, freedom of religion, etc. It just says the government shall not abridge it, or shall not establish a religion, which eventually abridges it for other people. Now, where that gets a little confusing is, for example, in the case of something like the Sixth Amendment, which says I have the right to confront my accusers if charged with a crime, and I have a right to counsel. Well, if the government charges me with a crime and I have no money, then I can't exactly acquit my right, no pun intended, I can't acquit my right to counsel by myself. And it's pretty meaningless for the government to say I have a right to counsel when it's charged me, it has paid the money for the prosecution, it has paid the money to bring in the witnesses against me, and I have no resources for defending myself. So in a case like that, the right has to become an affirmative right if it's to have any meaning at all. And this is where poverty has entered into the equation. So some rights, which are not self-executing and which are in fact triggered only by government action, do become positive rights almost perforce if they're to have any meaning at all. But other rights do not. So, for example, I can violate your freedom of speech, your freedom of religion if I want to. I'm not the government. And I can pretty much do whatever I want. Fortunately, I'm a person and I have no power anyway. So, the point is I could. And there are large and powerful institutions who aren't such nice people and who do have power and who will.
Yeah, but, I think it's an interesting idea that, You know, the all the Constitution says is that the state's supposed to leave me alone in terms of it practicing my religion or speaking freely and so forth. It doesn't say that the government, and this is what the conservatives are really, you know, getting into now, it doesn't say that the government has to do anything to assist me in gaining my rights. And I think Steve was mentioning the only real court case lately that's been guaranteed somebody a right to access was the Lane case, which was a case where the courthouse in Tennessee was inaccessible, and that a guy who's charged with felony would have to crawl up the stairs in order to get to the courtroom. And they say, well, in the case of a constitutional right, that's a different case from your right to get up the stair, to get into this hotel, or to go to school, or to get medical care, or anything else.
That was equal protection. The government was denying his right to its own services. That is, the court system is something the government creates, and it's there for the use of all the citizens. In that case, he had been summoned into court. He couldn't get into the court building. He, in one case, was carried up the stairs in or out of his wheelchair and was injured. In another case, he crawled up to a point. Finally, he refused to do anything and was cited for contempt of court. But here's a classic case. The government hailed him into court, and they said, we're not going to give you equal means of coming to court. Well, it sort of splits the difference between whether it was an equal protection case or a due process case. But it involved a very fundamental right, and that's why it became a constitutional issue. But if it had been another building, even a public building, where something so fundamental as access to the legal system was not at stake, the Supreme Court almost certainly would have said, well, it's too bad, it's unfortunate, but there's no constitutional right involved. Remember that in the case of Garrett versus University of Alabama Board of Regents, a Supreme Court case which held that Title I of the ADA, that's the employment discrimination provisions, could not be used by a private citizen to sue a state. And that has to do with some complexities under the 11th Amendment that I won't go into. But the point is, in that very case, Chief Justice Rehnquist, who, by the way, received tremendous reasonable accommodations, or maybe even more than reasonable accommodations for the Supreme Court when he was sick, including being allowed to work at home, which no Supreme Judge had been allowed to do in history for an extended period, including a special chair, and including many, many other reasonable accommodations. Nevertheless, I guess he didn't know what he was going to demand himself a little bit later. He said in that case that for the state to refuse to hire people with disabilities wasn't necessarily a bad thing, because it was based on the economic desire to save money that the accommodations would cost. It was a perfectly rational and reasonable thing for the state to do, potentially, and the Supreme Court certainly should not get involved in it. So he had two reasons for siding with the state of Alabama in the ADA case. First of all, because he didn't believe that individuals had a right to sue states under the Constitution in such a case, and second of all, because he didn't believe in the ADA anyway.
And I think that these tensions we talked about between groups in the disability movement partly stem from different philosophies about these things. I know, for example, that the National Federation of the Blind thinks that we have a very limited right, if any at all, to ask to demand, you know, audible description on TV and audible traffic signals and so forth. They not only believe that it's that those are not rights that we should claim, but that it will do us harm to ask society for accommodation, because I've actually heard people say, if you every time a sighted employer stands at a corner and hears one of those light signals go boop boop, you know, they will say, "Oh my God, that's for blind people. If I hire a blind person, they'll put boop boop things in my store, you know." That blind people have to be accommodated, and I can't do that, and therefore I won't hire anyone. And that's, and by extension, what happened way back in the, before the council, before ACB was formed, back in 1953 or 54 in the Federation, there was talk of the Federation joining up on some issues with a group called the League of the Handicapped, which is was a consumer organization of other people with other disabilities. And the leadership of the Federation said that blind people do not have anything in common to speak of, no more than they do with people in general, with other people with disabilities, because people in wheelchairs require ramps and wider doors and this and that, and that all blind people require is this negative right kind of thing. All we require is to be left alone and to be allowed to do jobs and to be, not positively discriminated against. And so this is one of those implicit things that I think enters into, without even people realizing it sometimes, enters into the differences among organizations. Another one that occurred to me, Steve, is that I think in the blindness system, and this is to some in the Federation, but also in ACB to some degree, we have this attitude that my right to live in the world or my right to be not discriminated against or whatever is conditioned on my ability to be physically independent. And, the fact that, that I can, we say, well, I'm entitled to be treated like everybody else because I can cook my own meals. That's ridiculous. If you, I always tell people that a deaf-blind quadriplegic still has the right to run his own life, his or her own life, and be, and make his or her own choices and so forth. Steve?
This recitation of history should not, of course, and I know that we don't intend it to be taken as criticism of any other organizations, because the imperatives of today and situations of today are, of course, quite different. An organization like the Federation, I have just at one of their legal conferences, in fact, something called the Ten Broke Symposium, where they had representatives of a wide variety of disabilities and even non-disabled civil rights organizations being together and talking together and all trying to figure out how to achieve the same goals, which is to reserve some measure of human decency on the part of government. The goal that really transcends any of the differences we've had in the past. There's nothing so clear as the old adage that nothing creates friends like having a common enemy. And right now we all have a common enemy. And while we might differ somewhat on exactly how to describe or how to identify that entity, we all know what that entity's current actions, if not long-term goals, are. Well, that may well be that may be the case. So anyway, so we all have to work now, I think, on figuring out how to bridge the historical gaps and how to bring about a common understanding and a degree of shared recognition of the problems we face. And I think that is a very important goal for all of us. And I think that's what we want to pursue today. So we want to talk about what some of the problems are, what some of the imperatives are. And I think that since there's been a disclaimer issued, and I'm now free to say pretty much what I want because it's been made clear that my views don't represent anybody, and as I say, possibly not even myself, for all I know, but I think it's fair to say that the situation we face today in this state is that you have, for example, in the context of the state legislature, a minority of the legislature, but a large enough minority to prevent the majority from acting. A minority of the legislature who regards itself as immune from electoral reprisal against human services. And as long as that is the case, And I know we have our wonderful outgoing Director of Governmental Affairs, Billy Frank Welty, over there. And Frank can speak to this, as he has spoken to it eloquently on many occasions, as to why hopefully we have some reasons for hoping that it may not be the case, or at least may not be the case to the same degree soon. But so long as it is the case, it means there's little chance of any kind of coherent public policy coming out of the legislature. And what we have more broadly on the national level, I believe, is a situation where those who can afford to buy the services they need for themselves, healthcare, education, transportation, etc., security, personal security, those who can afford to buy those services themselves have decided that it's cheaper and more efficient for them to buy them for themselves than to pay through them for them through the society, through the tax system. And once that happened, they decided they no longer have any need to care much about society or to pay any particular share of taxes that they can get away with not paying or use influence to get the law changed to help them avoid for not paying, because they don't need, by and large, what society has to offer. Oh, they'll pay for the military because they need that. And of course, they'll use their influence to get subsidies for the things they want. But basically, when it comes to human services, education, healthcare, they don't need to pay for them anymore because they can make a better deal privately on their own. And this is the problem that we face, ultimately, and this is, I think, behind the shift and the growing meanness in our public policy. And until or unless that can be reversed, either by a return to the kind of spirit that Roger was describing in the Japanese corporations, which they, by the way, no longer have either, until we can get a return to that spirit, or until we can do a number of other possible things, or until we face a crisis. You think back. Think back to after World War II. You know, some of us are old enough to remember. Some of you are old enough to remember. I'm old enough to remember. I'm actually old enough to forget. But many of you know that from about the end of World War II until about the mid-70s, we had a steadily rising standard of living, and we had a good, healthy middle-class society. We prized education. We had good health care. We had good jobs. Now, why did that happen? It happened because corporations were better in their intentions or had greater morality or cared more for people than they did now? No, it was in their interest. After World War II, the government's main concern was to make sure the returning veterans were happy enough not to be influenced by communism. And in fact, there's a lot of serious work that's been done by historians about how the government went about making sure that happened, including by fostering suburbanization on the theory that if you had your little house, you'd be more conservative. So that all went along fine. How do we have good education? Because it was in the interest of the powers that be, shall we say, to have well-paid, effective employees. And why do we have good health care? Because it was in the interest of the powers that be to have the workforce healthy. Well, for a variety of reasons, it's not that anybody doesn't want the workforce to be healthy or well-educated. It's that the needs of certain sectors of society, certain sectors of business, certain sectors of government have changed. They no longer have those needs. They can get workers more cheaply elsewhere. They can buy their own health care more cheaply. And education will produce the smaller and smaller number of people they need, whether they particularly invest in its quality or not. So all of us, from the standpoint of advocacy, if my analysis is even half right, if I'm even a halfwit, we come to the question of what it is that we need to do, what we can do as citizens to bring about a reversal in this, or at least to slow our descent into what can only be called a third world society. And that's what you all need to think about. Whether you agree with my particular analysis or not, if not, go out and find your own. There are plenty of alternatives around. But whatever analysis you find, you have to work with it. You have to find some way to turn that analysis into something more than a thought process, turn it into some kind of action, some kind of statement that you're here, that you're alive, that you have worth, and you have meaning, and that no one can take that away.
I wonder if do you suppose that the change of corporations from being operated by the people who started them, who like, for, you know, GE being operated by guys who make electrical equipment, to corporations being run by people whose only interest is money, is part of that? You have a comment?
Yeah, I think that. That might be a little bit. It's a nice romantic view. I wish I could hold it, but when you think about it, Thomas Edison's greatest accomplishment was not as an inventor. Thomas Edison's greatest accomplishment was he created the modern corporate laboratory system. Because he hired young inventors. He brought over Steinmetz. He brought over Nikola Tesla. He hired great young engineers and inventors, and they all invented stuff for him that he owned the patents to. He created the modern corporate laboratory. That was his great success. I don't think he actually invented anything after about 1886, and most of the things he did invent were accidents. Of course, he was an inventor and a great inventor. I don't mean to take it away from him, but that's not his greatest accomplishment or his greatest achievement in American history. Same with General Motors. Kettering was an inventor. To a certain extent.
Starter, I believe.
That's right. He was really an inventor. He invented the electric self-starter. But Kettering's greatest role, along with Alfred Sloan, was as the people who ran General Motors. And they ran it pretty much as ruthlessly, as self-interestedly, as any corporation ever was. In fact, they had a secret subsidiary which manufactured the lead additives that went into the gasoline, even though they knew the lead was toxic. But why did they do it? Not because they're good or bad, but because they had certain business interests, which at one time were more beneficial to large numbers of people than they are now. They weren't better people or worse people. The founders weren't better people or worse people. Andrew Carnegie's faith in God made him give away money. John D. Rockefeller's faith in God made him keep all of his. So yeah, same God, different people.
Oh dear, totally slipped from my mind. I was going to. Yeah, right. That's a really interesting point. It seems to me though that even though yes, those corporate things were happening. Oh, I know. I was going to say it's pretty well documented that those guys also destroyed public transportation, right? Trolley car system, the key system in San Francisco, and all. But I know even in my own lifetime, which is somewhat longer than some here, it seems to me that companies, that stores, and so forth, used to be owned by people who were interested in providing a service to the community, and that even companies like Cisco Systems and all the Silicon Valley things were started by guys who were, you know, who were really interested in doing what they were doing, creating the technology and so forth, and that gradually they were pushed out and the money people, you know, took over the, I can't keep track now of who owns what, whether Coca-Cola owns General Motors or General Motors owns Coca-Cola, I'm not quite sure. anyway, it feels that way. And then there's also globalization, right? You mentioned that they can get cheaper workers somewhere else. You didn't used to be able to get workers somewhere else, did you?
That's right.
But I would argue that we're all responsible. Because whenever we put price ahead of source, without asking where it was made, by what workers, at what wages, under what working conditions, which we all do, there's not a one of us, I think, who will ever say, well, gee, you know, I like that price, I'd buy it, but it costs less, and therefore it costs so much less, therefore I'm suspicious that it was made by people who aren't paid very well, and therefore I'm not going to buy it. Do any of us do that? Occasionally, hopefully, we all do. But by and large, we don't.
I refer to cost plus imports as the Southeast Asian child exploiters.
Right. So let's make no mistake. Part of our standard of living has been, and I fear will continue to be, achieved off the backs of poorly paid people in other countries and poorly paid people in our own country. Does anybody think that all the undocumented workers are here because any reason other than the fact that there are available jobs? Why else are they here? Why else has undocumented immigration so much slowed over the last 3 or 4 years? Because the jobs are not. Why are the jobs available? Because they're low paid jobs. People say Americans won't take them. Well, probably won't because they're too low paid. Only people who have no leverage at all will take them. Say again? Well, that's right, yes. Exactly. I don't understand the question. Forgive me. Could you elaborate on the question?
So the question is, well, I don't know what the question is.
It's a rhetorical question, maybe.
Low pay is probably the low paid person.
That's right. That's why people are here. Exactly.
Is better than nothing.
That's why people are here. You're exactly right. Exactly right. Now, for the person with a disability who may or may not have access to some minimal benefits in the form of SSI or SSDI, it becomes a more complicated matter because, as many of us know, the availability of low pay is compromised by the risk of the loss of the benefits. So the pay gets even lower. It becomes, in some cases, almost negative pay.
I think that part of it is that the living to this whole idea that came, as you mentioned, out of after World War II, that everybody's standard of living was getting higher, and it kind of got to be the idea that that was a law of physics or something, that your standard of living would keep getting higher. I notice nowadays, and I comment on it, what young people's expectations are in terms of like how they live while they're college students. When I was a college student, I lived in really funky places. I mean, the places that wouldn't even be allowed to exist under building codes now, with oil stoves in the house, and just very strange. And I had all the time I was an undergraduate and a graduate student, and even into my first job, I had really funky used furniture that I bought secondhand. It was really in poor shape. It seems to me now like people expect to be, while they're undergraduates, to be able to own a house. You know?
You can look at the statistics. For example, if you divide the college attending population by quintile, by which I mean this, a lot of statistics divide the population into five groups of 20% each, the top 20%, the next two, and the bottom. So, for example, you divide incomes that way. If you look at college attendance, the people in the lowest quintile, the lowest 20%, the percentage of them going to college peaked in 1979. I mean, you only have to ask yourself, if the cost of college in this state, take this state as an example, because it was once the... my point is that if the cost of going to school here have not gone up dramatically, college attendance is going down, and I think the argument that college students live better today is part misleading feeling that we get based on the fact that the people who go into college today are a wealthier subset than was the case before. And so we have that impression. And of course we're all influenced by commercials, which are advertising to this cohort who can afford to pay. But for the majority of people, college is growing more and more out of reach. That is going to be a problem for the future. The people who have the stewardship of this state don't care about so much, whatever they say. And the reason they don't care about it is because the number of educated people they actually need to work here is very small, and they'll get that number out of the private educational system. No matter what happens to public education, they'll get it out of the few people in public education who have the incentive or the ability to get a good education anyway. They don't need to care about the rest. The rest of us are just pretty expendable.
And they'll get it from overseas.
That's right.
Or the Middle East or whatever, and they'll pay whatever the price doesn't have.
Well, the UC has just undertaken, got a lot of publicity, as you may have noticed, a campaign to attract more out-of-state and more out-of-country students because pay more tuition and more fees. So why shouldn't the UC, you know, why take any California students at all except for football players? Why bother?
Well, I'm not convinced that it's a social good for people's families to have to pay for their college.
It's not a social
good. I have to get out of college with $100,000 in debt.
And consider how that prevents people from making socially responsible career choices. If you get out of college with $100,000 in debt, you have to find the career path that'll make you the most money.
Work on Wall Street.
That's right. I mean, even people who get out of law school, who I've known, wanted to be public interest lawyers. They couldn't afford to be public interest lawyers. They had huge debts. Well, of course, wouldn't you?
I don't know. Obama says he wants to pay more taxes. President Obama. He's talking about.
But again, I don't want us to get off on a, you know, a complaint rant, which we could all easily and justifiably do. I want us to get back to the question of what lessons we can learn from history and from the present that can help us to do something about it. That's what we're here to talk about today. We all have complaints, and you know, probably most of us have a general agreement on what's going on and why, subject to a few nuances of difference here and there. But the real question is, what kind of advocacy can we do today as an organization, as CCB, as ACB, as individuals in our homes and communities and towns every day? What can we do that would make a difference? And that's what I think we need to be talking about today.
Before and during World War II to help build that society that was focused on creating a middle class. And part of it was unionization, and part of it was the need for workers, and with the war. And those kinds of things helped really focus. Industry had needs, there were lots of people who needed work, and they needed to work together. Right now, industry doesn't have needs for people here, at least, making things, but we certainly, the general population has needs to be doing better, and the two are divergent right now, and we need to figure out ways to make them converge.
You know, there were a lot of blind people who had jobs during the war.
That's right, yeah.
It's the
laid off as soon as the war was over.
Absolutely. A lot of women, too.
Soldiers.
That's exactly right. Well, I think that Frank and Roger make a very good point. As Frank says, during World War II, first of all, we had a real feeling of collective threat. We really did believe we were all in danger, though. And there's nothing that does spur people to work together so much as common threat. We've seen that in our own lifetime. We've seen that after 9/11. We've seen it on a couple of other occasions. So a common threat will do that. And again, there was a need for workers. The head of the Selective Service System, a man, Paul may not remember him, some of us, his slogan was work or fight. And everybody worked or fought. And as Roger says, even blind people worked. Blind people worked in defense plants. Blind people worked in all kinds of things. In fact, you remember the additional tax exemption that blind people used to have? It's now been reduced to what's called an additional standard deduction for blind people and senior citizens. That had its origins during World War II. It was felt that the tax law that blind people, since they were so poor, should be given a little bit of a tax break. And that's where that originated. How do we create that same sense of shared need today? How do we create that sense of urgency? How do we do that? Is that what we need to do? Or how do we make it necessary for industry to once again need and want the skills of a large number of well-educated, healthy, and reasonably happy people? And how do we create the situation where the people who are doing the work will be the consumers so that it becomes valuable to their employers that they have enough disposable income to buy the goods that they're producing? How can we bring those things about? Are those the approaches we need to follow? And if so, how do we do it?
Well, I guess I have a question related to that, and that is, if everything works in this kind of economically motivated, rational choice way, how come the history, the last 40, 50 years of work with people with disabilities didn't work better at getting people with disabilities employed? You know, the idea was, I remember going, I used to be a member of the President's Committee for Employment of the Handicapped, and the idea was, if we train people with disabilities and get them all kinds of really good training, and we match them to the jobs that are required, they'll be hired in those jobs, and they'll work for 50 years, and they'll retire on a good pension, and everything will be cool. And you know, a corollary of that is, oh, it's that the reason people don't hire people with disabilities is that they're ignorant about what they can do. I'm not sure I buy that. I think it's a deeper thing than that. I think they don't hire people with disabilities because they don't want them around. The reason I use this crude joke that came from a long time ago about hire the handicapped, they're fun to watch, is that I think that the reason they don't hire them is that they're not fun to watch. In other words, I think it's that they don't behave like everybody else. They're different, and it's not a rational thing about, I don't think a blind person can do this job. It's that I don't want to have to deal with blind people.
So many disabled people leave the workforce earlier than others. And I think a lot of that goes along with what you're saying, Roger, about people not wanting to have disabled people.
Well, yes, it was recent data presented by Tom Harkin, data that comes out of the recent reports of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I think you have to distinguish between why people with disabilities in general, people who are blind or visually impaired in particular, are leaving employment. This was about federal employment in particular and employment generally. Why they're leaving employment at a faster rate than other people. I think we have to distinguish somewhat there between that issue and why people are not getting jobs to begin with. I think if we want to talk about the reasons for leaving employment, they're pretty complex. They have to do with the inaccessibility of technology, with the increasing stresses associated with employment, with the increasing difficulties of transportation, with the increasingly unreasonable demands of employers who have more workers to choose from. So why shouldn't they make more unreasonable demands? You looked at any job ads lately? Do you realize what they're asking? You probably have to have a PhD and a Nobel Prize to get any job at all, just about. You have to know 7 different software programs. It doesn't matter what the job is, almost. And the demands are quite ridiculous. And I've seen so many jobs that had to get relisted 3 or 4 times because they couldn't fill them, even in a period of large-scale unemployment. And partly it's because the demands are so unrealistic, and partly because we don't have an educated workforce in terms of the jobs people really need. As to why people with disabilities in general or people who are blind don't get jobs to begin with, we could discuss that all day. We've all discussed it many, many times for many, many years, and there are many, many reasons, and it's certainly not for us to hypothesize here what the reasons are. We all have our good sense of what those reasons are, but the point is, it's an intractable problem. But again, getting back to the present, how is it going to change? How is it going to get any better when there's such a residual pool of unemployed and underemployed people who don't have disabilities? What chance do we get? And how is it going to change when, in fact, the whole traditional historical notion of a job, an entry-level job, as the beginning of a career ladder, when that notion has no viability, no meaning anymore? When jobs are increasingly temporary, increasingly come without benefits, increasingly come without career paths, and otherwise don't meet again, the traditional post-World War II vision, which was what all VR was based on, and to a certain extent is still based on. Remember, it's called rehabilitation. Rehabilitation. Well, fine. Re of what? You know, I wasn't rehabilitated before. I didn't have a job. I wasn't a soldier who went away from a good middle class life and came back with an injury and needed to have some physical, impairments addressed or have my attitude adjusted. No. That's a different situation. And this is why we don't know what to do with all the traumatized and, neurologically and psychologically injured veterans of the current two wars. We have no idea how to help them with them. We have no model that even begins to address their situations.
And their injuries are very different than the kinds of injuries that we've had in other wars.
Exactly. And those costs, too, are going to continue increasing. The economist Joseph Stiglitz has studied. I want to throw something out here for guests. Does anybody know in what year the costs to the taxpayer of caring through the VA system-wise of World War II veterans peaked? Anyone want to guess?
46?
Try again.
1946?
Okay, that's your guess. Anybody got a better guess? Another guess, I mean?
1994.
Yes, because what happened was, as people got older, the cost kept going up, but people started dying off, and the two curves crossed in 1994. Now that means, if the Afghan war ended tomorrow, the cost of caring for the veterans of that war and the Iraq war would probably not peak until about 2060 or 2070. Think about that. And this is a bit of austerity. And don't think that they're going to be spared. Don't think that.
Talk about deficits.
Yeah. Don't think all the rhetoric about caring for our veterans. American history, the only war after which we really did take good care of our veterans was World War II. And I maintain the reason for that was the fear of communism. After the Cold War ended, there was no longer any fear of communism. If you're dissatisfied with the United States today, what are you going to do? Go join Al-Qaeda? I don't think so. You know, there's no fear anymore. There's no communism, which is just as well. Don't get me wrong. I mean, the world is better off without communism by a long shot. But a lot of the benefits that we had, we grew up taking for granted, were an artifact of the fear of communism.
Zoopalism.
It's
not just political, social.
Of course.
And economic,
yeah.
Of course.
So it wasn't Harold Russell,
huh? No, it wasn't quite all Harold Russell. Great, great man that he was.
He was chairman of the President's Committee when I was, you know, he was the guy that was in the best years of our lives, the guy with no hands.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah.
Somebody in the back has something?
Don't you think that it seems like, you know, the society kind of runs like a behavioral, where, you know, in the laissez-faire years, came down on the industries, they were ripping everybody off, and that's when the unions thrived and all. And don't you think that they're kind of become aware of keeping society or the culture in... So they think that they're getting everything they want, and sort of a public relations, you know, they're spinning things that it makes corporations look better than they really are. It's kind of like the gas prices are going up, but the oil companies are making tons of money, but we're giving them breaks on taxes and all, but they spin it in such a way that it looks like if we're taking it away for people that don't have money, they're saying, well, those people are stealing, and you know, the poor people are stealing and cheating, things like that. It's kind of like a public relations move to kind of keep that attitude.
Yeah, it's nothing new though. I mean, everybody uses public relations to make themselves look good, no matter who they are. You know, each of us as individuals, every organization. Well, sure, if I have the money to hire the best public relations agent, who am I going to hire? The worst one or the best one? I'm going to hire the best one. And you know, if I want to go into public relations, I'd want to be the best one, hired by the people who could pay me the most money. There's nothing, you know, absolutely, that's certainly correct. That's to be expected. I think it's important for us to be able to...
that public relations, you know,
its populations are, you know, given certain access and all, that they will achieve and they will do better. That's how do you swing that when you have the Rush Limbaugh type show.
But no, but it's not Rush Limbaugh. It's us. It's all of us. It's all of us. It's all of us. Like I said, how many of us here refuse to buy, you know, products that we can certify how they were made because we care more about wages than we do about our own short-term pocketbooks? How many of us can afford to? How many of us really care about privacy over convenience? Not a one of us. I would say not a one of us, but systematically. How many of us would take an hour longer to get to and from work in order to take mass transit because it's better for the environment? How many of us, and I'm as guilty as anybody, it comes down to all of us, what we do, and what I therefore want us to get back to, what can we do? Not as individuals. Sometimes acting as individuals is a waste. It doesn't matter how much I recycle. That's not going to do any good for the environment. That really isn't the point. What I buy is going to do some good for the environment if I can get thousands of people to agree not to buy things which are more polluting in favor of things which are less. Take us as people who are blind or visually impaired. Do we use our buying power to buy accessible technology? No. Do we go to the companies that make mainstream technology and say, look, if you don't buy it, make it accessible, we're not going to buy it. No. None of us is going to live without a VCR, without a cable. So we'll get 10% of the benefit, or 20%. But we're not going to not have cable, to make our point. None of us are going to say to our families, don't buy a washing machine if it's inaccessible. And our families would probably laugh at us if we did, and say, get lost. So it comes down to what we can do, not as individuals, but what, as individuals working together, we can do to figure out what it is our goals are, what we need, what are the lynch points, and how can we change minds and attitudes, our own, other people's. We have to start with our own, but we can't stop with our own. There's too much emphasis upon changing oneself. Changing oneself is a part of it, but that's only the first step. It can never be the last step or the only step.
Better to buy those products now because sometimes they're now cheaper and they're also good for the environment. And that's really where we have to look in all directions to try and make products that are beneficial to everybody, economically beneficial to everybody too.
That's right. How can we do that? Anybody here own any stock, share stock in some company? Do you ever think of putting in a shareholders resolution at the annual meeting?
Yes.
It can be done. That's a good thing to do. I mean, obviously it's not going to get passed, but it'll get publicity. It'll get a forum for a very important issue. And it's worth doing. Anybody here, seriously, write to companies and follow up with them? And, anybody here advocate through the other organizations or any organizations they're in for a collective action that would make sense? We have to think about what those things would be. We have to take every opportunity and we have to be very clear about what it is that we really want. And we have to, as I get beyond competition, because I assure you there's nothing that would serve the status quo better than the competition among the disadvantaged for the crumbs. And that's what's happening in policy today. If you see groups of people with different disabilities being pitted against each other, subtly or not so subtly, or you go to a legislator and they say, well, the other people came here last week and they said something different. Why don't you people come back when you agree? Don't fall for that. Don't fall for that. It's just an excuse.
So should the Randolph Shepherd vendors be against the candy bar legislation?
No, the Randolph Shepherd, it should certainly have every good reason to be against candy bar legislation. I think that again, the issue is choice to a large degree. Now, obviously, you could criticize me. You could say, well, you didn't care about choice before, did you? But you can't blame them for not talking about things that they didn't know about. You can't blame people for not getting involved in issues that they're not aware about, that don't touch their daily lives. Everybody has only a limited amount of time and energy. I mean, I'm shocked by the way that the Transportation Security Administration treats valuable musical instruments. I have friends who are musicians. I've heard stories about instruments being taken apart for search. But I can't do anything about that. That's not my issue. I can't, you know, the musicians have to take care of that. There's nothing I can do. I can't go out and demonstrate for them. I don't have that much time. I feel for them. You know, if they give me a place to send money to, maybe I could do that. But, you know, so you can't blame the vendors for not, you know, standing up for choice before when it involves something else. They do have a right, every reason to stand up for choice now. And in fact, again, the point is that it's not as if those things won't be sold. So what it's really about is a competition for who's going to sell them. It's not about selling them or not selling them. It's a competition between who's going to sell them. And it's actually a way of undermining the Randolph Shepard program by making these things more readily available through non-Randolph Shepard vendors. That's what it's really about. It's a covert way. That's not intentional. That's not what the legislatures were thinking about. Yes, but that's what it would do. That's not what they were thinking about. That's not their intention. There's no conspiracy here. That's just a byproduct.
The thing that I thought was interesting was when we were talking last week about a bill, a couple of conservative Republican senator and a representative have put in bills to roll back the changes that are going to be required in the production of light bulbs, because incandescent light bulbs are such profligate wasters of energy. And, you know, the conservative folks are doing it because they just don't like the government to tell us what kind of light bulbs we want, and probably because for other reasons too. But anyway, I saw an email from somebody in this organization who said, oh my God, we're on the wrong side on the candy bar thing, and now we're going to be on the wrong side of the light bulb thing. Just because low vision people want to be able to see, you know, I don't know. In other words, the issue is that a lot of low vision people say that they can't see as well with fluorescent bulb, with the energy, you know, with energy conservative light systems. And so they don't want the incandescent bulbs to go away until, there are other lights you can buy that work for low vision people. And, so my attitude was, I don't want to get in bed with those right wing guys anyway, even if they're right.
So the question you're asking is, what kind of alliances are ethical, and what kind of alliances, even for the sake of expediency, should we avoid? Be careful who your friends are, because they might think you're their friend. And the second issue is, what is selfish and what is really communal? You're asking, when are we being selfish and when are we being communal? And when do we need to be selfish and when do we need to be communal? And these are not easy questions to answer. None of these are easy questions to answer. I have no straightforward and simple answer. I myself, you know, if I believed there were a devil, would cheerfully work with the devil if the devil was serving some interest that I believed in. Or anybody else for that matter. I wouldn't fall victim to the belief that they're my long-term friend or they have my interests at heart. But I would certainly work with them if I could get something that I needed done important. Think about the ADA, for example. Why did the ADA get passed? I mean, again, we can talk about that, but I believe it's because at a certain brief moment in history, the belief that it would actually create more jobs and the desire for social justice converged. Just for that brief moment. At the right moment. So the people who wanted more employment and less welfare said, great, we'll pass the civil rights law, we'll get more people jobs, less people on welfare, that's great. And the people who believed in social justice said, great, we want less discrimination, here's the chance. And just for a moment, at the right moment in history, those two sets of interests converged. And so we're fortunate enough to get the ADA. Now you could say, well, we should not have worked with, you know, certain business interests and certain right-wing interests who all their only job was to cut SSI and SSDI and to get more people off the welfare rolls. But if it was in a good cause, sure. Now on something like the light bulbs, is it selfish? Am I putting the interests of my low vision needs as an individual ahead of those of the planet? I don't know. I'm not a scientist enough to know that, but I do know that it's a fair question to ask, but I think I'd have to come down on the side of people with low vision, because a society were to say, well, we're going to get rid of incandescent bulbs, but we understand you have an issue, and we'll take some measures to protect your right to read, your right to see, your right to independent living using the techniques that you've become accustomed to using. We'll take some measures to protect those rights. Then I'd say fine. Then I'd be in favor of, you know, have whatever kind of light bulbs you want. Have no light bulbs at all. I don't care. But if until somebody says we're going to take responsibility for all the consequences of what we do, then those consequences have to be taken into account in deciding what to think about them. Are those people out in the hall? Yes.
Steve, have you written a book that I could get on Facebook?
Well, I've written a couple of books. They go back a ways. One was on financing assistive technology, and one was on the use of the tax system as a source of subsidization for people with disabilities, tax option strategies for people with disabilities. Those are my two books. They're both.
How much of that book is still applicable?
Oh, I'd say about 40 or 50%. The principles are still applicable. For example, the one principle that I firmly allege is you should always file a tax return, even if you don't owe any money. And the reason for that is so that if you run for public office, you can release your back returns. And the other principle that I averred very clearly in that book was that seriously, there are some people, I've actually known people, who are so obsessed with taxes, they prefer to have no income just to avoid paying taxes. And that doesn't, I had a neighbor like that once. I used to, she was 90 years old, but she figured that avoiding taxes was her primary goal in life. So she actually invested all her limited money in government bonds that paid no interest. But she didn't care, she was avoiding taxes. Well, taxes are great. You pay taxes on what you earn. So, you know, the more taxes I pay, the better. As far as I'm concerned, it means I'm making money. So those are the two things that are still both completely correct. The rest of the stuff, some of it is valid, some of it is not.
Okay, what is your last name?
Mendelssohn. And you can see my picture in any nearby post office. S-O-H-N. No, he had two S's. He also had talent.
He had what?
He also had talent. apart from that, we're alike. Roger has a rather odd spelling with his name, too. It's spelled with an E rather than an O, right, Roger?
I'm sorry?
Your name has a rather unusual spelling also. It's spelled with an E rather than an O, right?
Yeah, WordPerfect 5.1 said that my name didn't exist.
My parents tried to say the same thing about me, but.
So, what does this mean about how we can get to love our friendly neighborhood independent living people? I'm not sure where we've gone from where we started, but. But then that's not always important. Sometimes it's just important to get people's neuro-nutritive juices running and flowing and so forth. But I think it's important that we all just be somewhat reflective. Don't let the email and the cell phone keep you from thinking, and we can. By the way, I was going to tell you, Steve, about we're talking about doing things for yourself, buying your own stuff versus, you know, paying taxes, doing socially responsible things. I had a friend who's from Nigeria, and he said, "I want to take Milton Friedman to Lagos and show him what real free enterprise is all about." He said, "There, if it starts to rain, the bus fare goes up." And he said, the people on the bus can vote on where they want the bus to go. If a lot of people on the bus don't want to go where it normally goes, the driver will drive it somewhere else. Now, there's an idea, you know. But that strikes me as being, when people say, oh, government shouldn't do this and government shouldn't do that, do we really want a society where we put the streetlights in front of our houses and pay for the electricity for them? I don't, you know. Of course, there's still vestiges of that, where you have people who don't have sidewalks because they don't pay for them.
Right.
There's a lot of unthinking kind of knee-jerk reaction to what should be done by government and what should be done by individuals and what should be done by voluntary organizations and what difference it makes. As I said, I really think that to require families to go into heavy, heavy debt in order to send their kids to college just doesn't make any sense to me at all. I liked it when I went to the University of Oregon, the tuition was $90 a quarter. And I think at that time the University of California tuition was free or something, wasn't it? Shouldn't it be that way? I don't know. Yeah, Bernice says at University of Arizona it was $116 a
quarter. But you can still go to prison for free.
You can go to prison for free.
Prison for free.
That's right, they're going out.
And you can get an education.
Yeah, how are the education programs?
Somewhat.
I know they have to have law libraries, I understand, under the law.
Yeah. But I want to make a contention that there is no... I want to contend that all the rhetoric about what government should and shouldn't do aside, there's nobody in this country who believes in limited government, by which I mean this. Anybody given the power to get government to do what they want to do will use that power. I'll believe that somebody believes in limited government when I hear somebody say, I actually have the power to get government to do what I want, but I'm going to forbear to use that power because I don't believe the government should. I think the government should be limited. You find me that person. And I'll find you someone who sincerely believes in the government. I've never seen, when in 1994, when a certain political party who will not be named took control of Congress, the first bill introduced by a conservative senator from New York, Alphonse D'Amato, who was a staunch conservative of an unnamed party, the first bill he introduced was a bill to withhold federal housing funds from any state that had control. Now, how can someone who believes in small government do that? So listen. So you find me somebody who says,
he was against social engineering.
Of course, you find me someone who says, I will forbear to ask the government to do something that I have the power to get it to do because I don't believe in big government. And then you'll show me someone who actually believes in limited government. Until then, I've never found a person yet.
I think we're getting close to trying to weigh this thing up.
I think we might have done more today to help the sleep study. We've done a lot to help the sleep study today. After us, they may not need to do it anymore.
I think it's definitely, you know, like you say, it gets the gray matter, you know, moving a little bit. very good questions that we need to consider. Because we do, you know, as collectively, you know, have to have some sort of idea where we're going and whether or not we're going to use methods from the past or have to change, given it's we can't think just nationally anymore, which we tend to do when we're older, you know, from the past. We have to think in a lot more global sense. You know, we're talking about just employment here, we're talking about employment everywhere, you know, all over the world.
That's right.
It's a lot. And so it's kind of uncomfortable being in this lot, all of a sudden, lot larger bubble, or I guess maybe even smaller bubble. It's just so many more people involved.
It's very complex. You couldn't be more right. And again, what we've hoped to do today is not to have you go away sharing our ideas, but as you just said, to go away in a thoughtful and introspective and energetic frame of mind. And we want to wish you all great success in your endeavors, and we want to thank you all very much for coming here and being with us today.
Okay, we're done.